A Missoula man is charged with deliberate homicide in the shooting death of a high school exchange student. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you what famous rock musician is headed to Washington Grizzly Stadium this summer. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the editor of National Geographic magazine about how the magazine has stayed relevant for 125 years. A 17-year-old boy shot and killed by a man who said the teen had broken into his garage was a foreign exchange student from Germany. 29-year-old Marcus Karma has been charged with deliberate homicide in the weekend shooting death of Deiran Didi of Hamburg, Germany. Didi was a junior at Big Sky High School in Missoula. Missoula Police Sergeant Travis Welsh says authorities received a 911 call just after midnight yesterday that there was an intruder in the house and there had been a shooting.
Officers arrived and found the male and female residents and also another male inside the garage who was the apparent victim of a gunshot wound.
Welsh says Didi had been shot twice with a shotgun. The shooter, Marcus Karma, told officers he found an intruder in his garage after an alarm went off and shot him. Welsh says there was a second person in the garage with Didi, but he ran when the shots were fired. Police have questioned him. Karma's bail was set at $30,000. Missoula County Public Schools spokeswoman Hatton Littman says Didi was a German national of Turkish descent who had been attending Big Sky High School since August. She says he had not been in any trouble and was a popular student.
He was a member of the soccer team and the track team. He was very involved around the school, and really students and staff speak very highly of him. It's a horrible shock. It's a tragedy for everybody involved. We're very sorry for the loss of Deiran and give our condolences to his family.
Students were not in school today because of a professional development day, but Lemon says grief counselors were available and will be at the school all week. Less than 2 hours before the Missoula shooting, a homeowner 350 miles away in Billings shot and wounded a house guest he thought was an intruder. Billings Police Sergeant Bill Curry says the 19-year-old seminary student was making a phone call in the home's garage late Saturday when he was shot. The student, who was not named, appeared to be shot in the chest, but Curry says the injury was not life-threatening. He says the homeowner probably won't face charges.
And in other news, a task force at the University of Idaho is trying to determine just what a new law allowing concealed weapons on campus means for the school. The Lewiston Tribune reports UI President Chuck Staben established the 14-member task force last month. That's when Governor C.L. Butch Otter signed into law a controversial measure allowing retired law enforcement officers and people with concealed carry permits to bring firearms onto public college and university campuses. Matt Dorschel with UI Public Safety and Security says task force members are still gathering information and they're getting a lot of questions. Some of the questions include whether a faculty member can ask classes to identify who is carrying a concealed weapon and what will happen in areas like the University Child Care Center.
A Billings man who is serving a 10-year federal prison sentence for what is believed to be the largest gun heist in state history faces an additional 5 years in the Montana State Prison for jumping bail on earlier charges. The Billings Gazette reports District Judge G. Todd Baugh sentenced 36-year-old Benjamin McChesney on Friday for failing to show up for trial in a drug possession case that was later dismissed. Prosecutors say McChesney and a co-defendant stole more than 130 guns from a freight trailer in Billings in 2010, and that McChesney fled to Mexico in May 2011, just before his drug trial. He was arrested 2 years later. McChesney argued the state was seeking the maximum 10-year sentence to punish him for other charges that had been dismissed. He suggested a fine.
57-year-old David Rapstad of Helena has died in a one-vehicle rollover on U.S. Highway 12 east of East Helena. The Montana Highway Patrol reports Rapstad was westbound just before 9:30 last night when his car went off the right side of the road. The patrol says he appeared to overcorrect, causing his car to rotate counterclockwise. The car then rolled and the driver was ejected. He died at the scene.
A Helena man who was fleeing law enforcement after reportedly trying to kidnap a woman drove his sport utility vehicle through a fence and went airborne before landing on Interstate 15. The Independent Record reports police arrested 27-year-old Thaddeus Jake Deschner yesterday on suspicion of attempted kidnapping, assault, and a probation violation. He also faces charges of driving under the influence and criminal endangerment. Minutes before the crash, Deschner reportedly grabbed a woman who was working in her front yard at about 11 a.m. yesterday and tried to force her into his SUV. He fled when the woman's husband confronted him. About 15 minutes later, Deschner apparently spotted a Lewis and Clark County Sheriff's Patrol car and sped off.
A part-time Jefferson County jailer is charged with trading cigarettes for sex with three female inmates. The Montana Standard reports 45-year-old Rodney Mortimore faces seven counts of sexual intercourse without consent, along with transferring illegal articles to inmates. He is slated to make his initial appearance in district court in Boulder on Wednesday. He has been assigned a public defender. Mortimore was arrested on April 12th, the same day a 19-year-old woman filed a complaint alleging she received cigarettes from Mortimore in exchange for sex over a period of several months. Court records say Mortimore acknowledged sex with the woman and said he brought cigarettes to other inmates. Two other women told investigators they received cigarettes from Mortimore in exchange for sex. Under state law, inmates cannot consent to sex.
Governor Steve Bullock is interviewing four people for a vacancy on the Montana Supreme Court. The questions the Democratic governor asked each nominee today included what changes he or she would like to see and how the court operates, and what role a justice's personal views should play in making decisions. The finalists chosen by the Judicial Nomination Commission are attorneys Elizabeth Brennan of Missoula, Amy Eddy of Kalispell, and Patrick Watt of Great Falls, along with Montana Workers' Compensation Court Judge Jim Shea of Helena. Bullock must make an appointment by May 9th to replace former Justice Brian Morris, who resigned to become a federal judge. The new appointee must be confirmed by the state Senate in 2015 and then elected by voters in 2016.
By almost anyone's definition, the concert scheduled for August 5th at the University of Montana's Washington Grizzly Stadium is going to be an epic event. UM announced today that Paul McCartney has added a stop in Missoula to his Out There tour. UM Adams Center Executive Director Brad Murphy says this concert has been a long time in the making.
Mike McGinley, who is a former alumnus of this university and is well attached to the entertainment industry, has been working on that for 6 years to try to get Paul McCartney here. And he's finally been able to get the routing and the revenue and the relationship put in place so that Paul will come to Missoula. And I've only been here two, but the day I walked into this door, I started working on it with Mike at that time.
The Out There Tour features music from McCartney's entire career as a solo artist, as a member of Paul McCartney and Wings, and as a Beatle. He also plays music from his most recent studio album, New.
High energy, almost 3 hours, big production, all the bells and whistles that go with any type of a Paul McCartney show. This is the full-on show. They will get the best of Paul McCartney.
The show includes massive screens, lasers, and pyrotechnics. Murphy says the ticketing company just sold out McCartney's July 12th concert for North Dakota's Fargo Dome. He says there were no reports of any significant problems. That said, Murphy predicts Montanans will have plenty of competition for tickets to Sir Paul's August concert.
But yeah, we'll reach to probably the provinces north to all the adjoining states, Idaho, Washington, Wyoming, North and South Dakota. Those tickets range from $250 on the field down to $49.50 in the northwest corners.
There will be no opening act. Murphy says the best way to get tickets when they go on sale at 10 a.m. on May 9th will be to go online at grizztix.com. They'll also be available at The Source at the University Center, Southgate Mall, Warden's Market, or MSU Hub. Murphy cautions against going to off-site markets or secondary buyers as the authenticity of those tickets cannot be guaranteed. If you get a counterfeit, you're out of a lot of money and will miss the concert. The last concert at UM Stadium featured the Rolling Stones, who entertained a crowd of over 23,000 people.
Chris Johns is the first photographer and ninth person to be editor-in-chief of National Geographic magazine. The Oregon native has led the magazine since 2005 and was in Missoula recently to lecture at the University of Montana. In this feature interview, Johns talked with news director Sally Mock about the magazine's evolution since it was started 125 years ago by Alexander Graham Bell, who headed the National Geographic Society.
And he made a very smart decision in hiring Gilbert H. Grosvenor to be the first editor of National Geographic magazine. He also happened to be his son-in-law, which worked out well. But yes, I mean, there's a very distinguished history to National Geographic, and Alexander Graham Bell was really one of the key players to kick it off.
But it wasn't until 1905, I read, that the magazine had photographs, which, of course, is what it's known for now.
Well, 1905, the January issue, was the first photo essay we had, and that was put in the magazine as a pure act of desperation. There really wasn't a plan at all.
Desperation because?
Because they had gone to the printer and realized they were 11 pages short of any content. They had nothing to put in the magazine, and Mr. Grosvenor, the editor at the time, the first editor of the magazine, opened a package from some Russian explorers who'd been to Lhasa, Tibet, and they were magnificent pictures, and he thought, well, this will be a simple way for us to fill those empty pages. I'll do that, and I may lose my job because this is a serious scientific journal, and the board of trustees may think it's frivolous, but I got to do something, and I like the pictures, so let's see what happens. And, of course, what happened was history was made. And
other
it was
people liked the pictures.
Yeah, people loved the pictures, loved the magazine. It was a smashing success. Several board members resigned or at least threatened to resign because of the frivolous nature of photographs in the scientific publication. But that really set us off to be a very visual organization.
And the Geographic has really, in the profession of photography, it's really been cutting edge.
Well, we have certainly tried to carry that tradition. We were the first to really dive deeply into underwater photography, and we did a lot of flash photography. We started to do more and more color in the magazine. First, we did color tinting of photographs in the magazine, which are actually magnificent. They're beautiful. And, of course, the other thing we've done is embrace technological change and looked at that as opportunities. The iPad, video, audio, immersive storytelling with all the great tools we have out there to tell stories.
I want to read a quote you've said in another interview about photography, and this is the quote you said, "I tell the photographers here, and the same goes for writers, show me and tell me what you see, but tell me and show me what you feel."
Well, that's right. That's where a photographer and a writer's voice become so important as we move the magazine forward and take opportunities for the kind of storytelling we can do that we really couldn't do a few years ago. I mean, you've got a camera now that can record high-definition video, can record audio. You can tell a much more complete story now. So then you can get much more to sharing how you feel about something, but in a very responsible way. I mean, National Geographic's a nonprofit organization. We don't have a political agenda, but we do feel strongly that intelligent conversations are a good thing for the world.
When you say voice, what do you mean exactly?
What I mean is that a photographer or a writer has a strong narrative sense and is able to stitch a strong narrative story together. And really, when they're very skilled at that, they become invisible. And then what their voice does is amplify the voice that they're connecting with, the voices they're covering. It could be the voice of Uyghurs in China. It could be the voice of a teen bride in Afghanistan. It could be really giving voice to African wild dogs or grizzly bears. I mean, or a great landscape like Montana has in spades.
I want to read another quote. You said, "Our board of trustees want us to make a positive difference in the world, to inspire people to think and do the right thing for all of us and for future generations." That's a little bit of a political statement, don't you think?
Well, we have a long history of moving the dial in public awareness. And so there's no question we're an influential magazine.
And you take on controversial topics, climate change, for example.
Absolutely. We've been covering climate change since the mid-80s. And, of course, an important part of our DNA is science. We support science. We send scientists all over the world. We send explorers all over the world. In 1888, we sent explorers up near Yakutat, up the Hubbard Glacier and Russell Fjord and Icy Bay. That's something we strongly believe in. We strongly believe in the value of human curiosity and of science. So we're going to cover climate change, absolutely, but we're going to cover it. We don't have a political agenda with climate change, but we do believe it's important for people to understand the science and what we are learning and to celebrate our ability to learn and then to share and educate.
You have, I read, 40 million people who read the magazine in 33 languages.
It's actually 39 now.
39 languages.
Yes.
Truly an international magazine. But still, you have to work hard to remain competitive given all the competition that's out there, don't you?
We do. I mean, and I love that. I mean, I love the fact that we have to be relevant. And our readers constantly tell us if we're relevant or not. And, of course, now we can reach audiences through the web, through mobile devices, through, of course, television. There are a lot of ways we can help people try to understand and appreciate the world.
Magazine around for another 125 more years, you think, Mr. Johns?
It's certainly our intention to make National Geographic relevant in people's lives. You know, what the magazine will be, how it will manifest itself, is happening right now. And it's really exciting because now you can, on your iPad or your tablet, have a magazine experience that includes video, that includes audio, that includes great writing, great photography, community interaction. We can share community pictures that from your shot, our community sharing photo site. There's just so much more the magazine can be as an experience across multiple platforms. And of course, we're really excited about the opportunities, not only with the web, but with mobile devices. So everywhere, anytime, you can tap in to National Geographic.
As visionary as Alexander Graham Bell was, he could not have envisioned all of that, could he?
No, but Alexander Graham Bell embraced technology and embraced change and had the ability to see opportunities. And that's really the place we're in now, is there are tremendous opportunities for storytelling and understanding and community engagement, community involvement worldwide. And that way, I think we can all listen to each other and make better decisions.
Well, I have been speaking with Chris Johns, who's the editor-in-chief of National Geographic Magazine. Mr. Johns, pleasure to have you in our studio again. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, look for mostly sunny skies with highs in the mid-50s to lower 60s. For central Montana, tonight should be mostly cloudy in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy. Look for isolated rain in the evening with lows 30 to 35 degrees and northwest wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies and a slight chance of rain through the day. Highs are in the 50s. Southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly clear skies with lows 20 to 30 degrees, and tomorrow should be sunny with highs 45 to 55 degrees.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 51 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's mostly cloudy and 55 degrees. Butte has 36 degrees under light snow. Great Falls is cloudy with 50 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under cloudy skies is 49 degrees. It's 45 and cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 49 degrees. Libby has 50 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are mostly cloudy and it's 53 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Julia Altimus.
I simply have to shake my head at the blatantly false accusations and statements made in the press lately by a few fringe environmentalists concerning Governor Bullock's priority landscape recommendations to the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. I normally do not waste my time countering crazy talk, but this time the accusations are so false and so out of line that they must be corrected. Forestry provisions in the Farm Bill are the direct result of several national concerns. Fire budgets, fire risk to public safety and infrastructure, lack of management on federal lands, litigation, and jobs. The forestry title of the 2014 Farm Bill sets into law new opportunities for governors and the U.S. Forest Service to work together on management of federal and non-federal lands within state boundaries. The section that is receiving the most adverse attention is Section 8204, entitled Insect and Disease Infestation, which gave governors the authority to recommend priority treatment areas to the Secretary of Agriculture by April 9th. Based on annual forest surveys, these areas are experiencing declining forest health, are at risk of experiencing substantially increased tree mortality over the next 15 years, or are in an area that the risk of hazard trees poses an imminent risk to public infrastructure, health, or safety. Governor Bullock was one of 36 governors that chose to engage in the opportunity presented by Congress. Based on the criteria specified in the Farm Bill, the governor recommended a priority designation on just under 5 million acres of the 12.5 million acres identified in forest plans as suitable for timber harvest or production. The Farm Bill is very specific regarding resource condition as a qualification, but completely void of specifying process. Idaho's Governor Otter turned to established collaboratives to identify areas. Other governors used different processes. In the spirit of collaboration, Governor Bullock chose to gather an ad hoc working group of diverse interests. The Forest Service and state agencies pulled together layers of scientific data and maps. The Forest Service presented draft areas to forest supervisors, county elected officials, representatives of collaboratives, environmental groups, and timber industry representatives for feedback. All future projects within the priority areas are considered authorized hazardous fuel reduction projects and will be carried out in accordance with certain authorities in the Healthy Forest Restoration Act of 2003. An additional provision not in HFRA is the ability to use up to a 3,000-acre categorical exclusion as long as the acres identified for treatment are recommended by a collaborative group or by a collaborative process. Categorical exclusion applies to actions that do not individually or cumulatively have a significant effect on the human environment. In addition, the use of a CE must not trigger extraordinary circumstances, such as the potential to adversely impact threatened or endangered species, archaeological remains, historical sites, or other protected resources. That's it. That's what the entire ruckus is about. So the few that are crying foul have either not read the bill or are deliberately trying to sabotage a bill produced by Congressional Conference Committee and the outcomes it will produce. Don't be fooled by false and inflammatory statements like a secret logging deal or categorical exclusions will treat an unlimited number of projects up to 3,000 acres or almost 5 square miles in size, or that a CE could be used where there is a likely to affect threatened or endangered species, or that to treat acres could mean a clear cut. Farm bill criteria and individual forest plans dictate pace and scale. Collaborative conservation emphasizes the importance of local participation, sustainable natural and human communities, and voluntary consent and compliance rather than enforcement by legal and regulatory coercion. Over the past few years, mainstream environmental groups and the timber industry have invited the few fringe organizations to enter into a collaborative discussion or process on numerous occasions. However, they decline in favor of the failed status quo of attacking projects through pre-objection and litigation. It is rather disingenuous for these people to cry foul now because they were not consulted. They sealed their own fate long ago by choosing the path of obstruction rather than construction. On behalf of the Montana Wood Products Association, I am Julia Altimus. Thanks for listening.
Julia Altimus is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.